Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, October 30th, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on Professor Tara Smith's new book, Judicial Review in an Objective Legal System. My name is Katie McClendon. I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Note also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Tara Smith, philosophy professor at the University of Texas and author of the book we are discussing today, and Gary Lawson, professor of law at Boston University School of Law. Professor Smith will give some opening remarks, then Professor Lawson will comment, and then we'll open the floor for your questions. Thank you both for speaking with us. Professor Smith, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. And I do want to start by thanking the Federalist Society very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about the book. And thank you to Gary Lawson for serving as the commentator today. And thanks to you, who I imagine are some people at least who've called in. Thank you for being interested in hearing about all this. So naturally, it's difficult to try to condense a book filled with arguments into a little, you know, 10 or 15 minute preview. I thought I would try to explain broadly at least my approach in the book and motivate the structure of the book a little bit and say a little something about some of its actual argumentative substance, just to give you a taste of some of its arguments. And I should say at the beginning, I am a philosopher. I'm not a lawyer. I don't have legal training. So I'm coming at these issues from the perspective of a philosopher. So basically the book, again, Judicial Review in an Objective Legal System. Well, the book is in two main parts. First part talks about objectivity in a legal system overall, and then part two, objectivity in judicial review. And the latter was really my original interest. But, you know, over the years, as I started really looking into this and exploring the scholarship on it, and it also just in even more popular debates about judicial review, I think many people would agree it's relatively easy in these debates about judicial review to say what we oppose, what, you know, the kinds of views we find fault with. But people, I think, are often not sufficiently careful about what they're for, about the justification of what they're for. And even many of the people who espouse theories that I'm most sympathetic to, I think, need to be a little bit more, well, much more rigorous about really laying out exactly what the objective meaning of law is. And I came to think, as I explored this area, that you can't understand proper judicial review in isolation from understanding a proper legal system more broadly. The courts, judicial review, these are components of a larger system, and its purpose and framework establish the contours for proper review. I also found in studying different accounts and defenses of these differing accounts that views of courts' fidelity to the law, you know, if that's the thing that pretty much everybody will at least say that they want, courts' fidelity to the law, well, different views of what that fidelity is inevitably presuppose different views of the identity of law, of what the law itself is. And these inescapably depend on assumptions about the authority of law. That is, you know, what it is that renders some given written rule a genuine, to-be-respected law. So what I've come to think, again, is that you can't really do legal philosophy, or that legal philosophy can't avoid certain issues, at least certain basic issues of political philosophy, about the basic nature and purpose of government. Thus, in the first part of the book, I have a couple of chapters on that, on the authority of law, the basic moral authority and legal authority behind the law. So again, the first part of the book overall is really the groundwork for an account of judicial review. I've got chapters in there on the fundamentals of objectivity itself, which I go into in some depth, but for a layman, not for, you know, an epistemologist. I discuss the rudiments of an objective legal system overall, the core character of the rule of law, that ideal that people want, and the authority of law. And then the second part of the book zooms in on judicial review. And there, I've got a critical survey of five of the major competing accounts. I talk at length about textualism, the original public understanding view, Dworkinian aspirationalism, that you can, you know, that goes by different names, and I don't talk only about Dworkin's version of it, but, you know, living constitutionalism, we might say, popular constitutionalism, and judicial minimalism. So again, I critique all of these accounts. All of them, I think, suffer fatal confusions concerning either the authority of law or the objectivity of law, or both in some cases. And then I go on to chart my own view of objective review, and I have a chapter that talks about how courts should proceed under a legal system that's not ideal, meaning having set things up as, well, here's what an ideal legal system would look like, within that, what's objective review. I then do try to discuss the fact that we're not living in that ideal legal system today, so how might courts objectively proceed? Okay. So that's sort of the big picture overview of the book. What then would proper judicial review look like? What could I say about objective review here? Well, again, I've got an early chapter that explains objectivity itself and its essential demands. And in any sphere, I argue, a lot of what being objective demands stems from what it is you're after, what the goal is. So here, in this context, our compass must be the function of judicial review, which is to ensure that it's the law that governs. So I emphasize two factors as vital for proper judicial review: unswerving focus on the law, and an appreciation of the contextual character of law. Understanding any particular element of law in logical light of the full and relevant context, both local context and larger, that is, the facts of the immediate dispute, the principles governing the legal system more broadly. So again, those are the two major factors that I develop in the book. Let me say a little bit to elaborate on each of those here. I hope you're all with me. Of course, you know, without eye contact, I'm imagining you're all nodding sagely at all of this. So let's hope so. So a little bit on that first one. I said, you know, unswerving focus on the law, which I would think sounds kind of obvious, right? Hardly revelatory. Until we this doesn't make it revelatory, but I think that's easy to overlook, easier said than done, to have courts focus on the law. And to motivate that a little bit, I think we have to realize how extraneous are all the different factors that so many competing dominant theories of judicial review direct courts to pay attention to. So let me just trot through a few. I mean, we frequently hear in different language, in different ways, more or less directly, about deferring to the will of the people, right? I mean, but this is what the people want, or that would be divisive, or will this ruling enjoy mainstream support? We're a democracy, after all, right? So we hear, again, sometimes it's in criticism of certain rulings or direct calls for this. The problem with the will of the people is that that has nothing to do at a given time with whether the law in question or the action in question in a given dispute is indeed constitutional, and that's the court's assignment. Or consider frequent appeals to certain philosophical ideals, justice or equality or liberty or a caring community. Now, you know, these given ideals, some of them might be good, some of them might be bad, but the point is basically turning judges into philosophers who would figure out what our governing ideals should be and exactly what those mean and exactly what those authorize from the legal system. Or consider the claim that we should defer to precedent, right? It's previous courts' rulings that matter. We get this frequently in criticisms of certain rulings as too far, too radical a break from precedent. But again, obviously, as I'm sure is obvious to many of you, you know, judges swear to uphold the Constitution and not what others have said about it. Let me just trot through one or two more. We frequently hear about the size of a ruling. This is what the minimalists emphasize, right? Decisions of the courts should be narrow. They have to worry about the scope of impact, leaving only a very small footprint on the law. But again, all of which I argue is ultimately beside the point, or it's beside the law. That is, laws have differing scopes. The application of some laws will carry significant effects, and the application of certain other laws will have much more modest effects. But the impact of an objective ruling will be as large or as limited as the relevant law decrees. To insist on one size fits, you know, for all, one small size for all, as the minimalists do, is basically to distort whatever is the actual relevant law. Another red herring in debates about judicial review, balance. We often hear invocations of balance, which is frequently just a kind of nebulous, feel-good term that enjoys the aura of reasoned moderation, but often subverts the primacy of the law. Now, I'm not saying anytime anybody uses the term balance, it's necessarily, you know, a sign of some grave logical error, but you always need to be careful about balance. Balance of what? Balance by what standard? And I argue that the court should never balance the law against other ends that aren't what's legally mandated. To do that is to subordinate the law. Okay, let me move on. Let me just make a few remarks on the second crucial component of objective judicial review. All of that was about, you know, strict logical focus on the law, the contextual character of law. This was the second crucial component I mentioned. A person, an interpreter of the law, must understand the basics of the larger legal system, its mission, its authority, to properly construe any of its individual discrete elements. In a proper legal system, all of its parts and powers, specific rules and policies will reflect its primary animating purpose. Their legitimacy depends on that. Correspondingly, their legitimate meaning depends on that. A legal system's authority determines what its particular provisions could possibly mean in order to be consistent with that authority, as well as what they could not mean, since certain interpretations would give the government a power that it doesn't rightfully possess, that would exceed the government's actual authority. So contextual interpretation must respect the boundaries of government power. The more basic point here is that we must understand the overarching function of law and the authority of law to then derivatively understand the proper meaning of any single component of law, of the legal system. You've got to get the whole picture straight in order to get disputes about particular laws straight. And notice that in many spheres, people quite readily distinguish the spirit of a law from the letter of the law. I mean, this is a completely commonplace, taken-for-granted kind of distinction that people frequently accept, regularly accept. And I think in doing so, they're recognizing that context affects meaning, that the background and purpose of a rule help to illuminate its proper application. So my contention is that the letter of a law cannot be understood without understanding its spirit, without understanding the purpose and principles of the larger system. Our law in the U.S. is philosophical. Our Constitution is a means of fulfilling the government's purpose. It reflects a definite philosophy of government. In creating the powers that it does, and, you know, our Constitution also in the powers that it does not create or give to the government, and in its structuring of powers, in the safeguards it builds in, it's taking a stand on the proper relationship between government and governed. The courts must recognize that and make use of that. Now, this entails that objectivity on the part of courts requires judgment, which I think people often resist. Critics of activist courts often imply that judicial review should be a no-brainer, you know, with the answers self-evident. But it can't be a no-brainer. Understanding the correct application of abstract concepts, general rules, laws, to particular circumstances, it's an intellectual process. And the answers are going to be tricky sometimes. I mean, did the police have probable cause for that particular search? Was that sort of congressional break a recess? Is freedom of the press to withhold certain information from a government investigation, does that really qualify as freedom? Now, again, answering these will sometimes be difficult. There can be good reasons, at least prima facie, pointing in opposing directions. I don't think there's any way to convert this fallible process into something foolproof by some method that guarantees the right answer. So While those who are worried about judicial activists are right to insist that courts honor the law, what was written and enacted, it's important to appreciate what can't be written. You can't write down all the answers. Putting something in writing doesn't put it beyond thought. So again, the objective jurist is going to have to engage in a certain amount of genuine, fallible judgment. All right, I should really try to wrap up here. That's to give you just a taste of some of the sorts of arguments and angles that I pursue in the book. Just to underscore a few final thoughts. Again, if we want objective law, we need to confront what objectivity is. And again, I try to do that in depth early in the book. If we want objective judicial review, we need to confront the core of an objective legal system to be able to understand proper review within that system as serving that system. And throughout, I think, we have to understand the function of a legal system and of judicial review in order to then be able to identify their proper operation. Okay, let me leave it at that for now and turn it over.
Hi, thanks so much, Professor Smith. This is a really welcome book. It raises issues that are not raised nearly often enough, and for that we should all be grateful. It's really two books. Professor Smith mentioned that there's a part one and a part two. I would phrase it a little differently. There's a book one and there's a book two. Book one is not about judicial review. It's about the design of legal systems. It's really more about constitutional and legal drafting than it is about interpretation and adjudication. Part two deals with adjudication. I am actually more interested in book number one. That is a really wide-ranging, immensely valuable discussion that ranges across epistemology, moral theory, political theory, the relationship of all of those things to law. It's really terrific. Those are the kinds of questions and connections that are way too often overlooked in conventional discussions. And that is terrific. Let me just emphasize three things in particular that I think are especially noteworthy, then offer two related criticisms, and then move on to the second part, or book two, as I call it. The three things that I particularly think are worth the price of admission is, number one, the description and discussion of the nature of objectivity in general. That may sound disconnected from law, but knowledge in law is a special case of knowledge more generally, so there's really no way to think carefully about law without thinking carefully about some of these underlying issues. That's thing number one. Thing number two, and this is going to sound obvious, Professor Smith breaks down the idea of objectivity in law into three distinct questions. You have to focus on what the government does, how the government does it, and where the government gets the authority to do that. That just sounds so simple. It's actually a very, very powerful analytical framework. And the third thing that I especially liked was her discussion of the nature of the rule of law. Now, Professor Smith and I do not agree, I don't think, on the precise correct account of the rule of law, but what I think we do agree on is that it is an impoverished view to see it as a purely formal rather than a substantive idea. So there's just a wealth of information in that part, the first half, roughly, of this book on how one would think about the design of a legal system. The two things that I would have liked to see more on, and that I would have liked to see maybe as book two of this project. Professor Smith has an extended discussion of why written constitutionalism is the right way to go in legal design. In the end, I think she's right, but I think she makes the case seem much easier than it really is for two reasons. First is, I think she underestimates the power and capacity of certain forms of common law reasoning. Now, there are certain things that go by the name of common law reasoning, like the constitutional common law scholars, such as David Strauss, that she criticizes quite ably in part two. That's just a simple following precedent model. There are much more sophisticated models of what common law decision-making and reasoning involves, the Hayek, Bruno Leone-inspired models that view it as a way of gathering and accumulating dispersed knowledge. It's also a risk-averse device. And that leads to my second comment. Just as I think she possibly underestimates the capacity of common law reasoning, I don't think she gives sufficient consideration to the risk-return ratio of written constitutionalism. And I want to be clear, at the end of the day, I think she's right, but I think the case is harder to make than she thinks it does. Written constitutions are, as we would say, very high beta operations. If you know what the right answers are and you actually get the right answers, the returns are very high. If you don't know what the right answers are, or you do know what the right answers are, but you get the wrong answers, or, as may often happen, you don't actually know whether you've got the right or wrong answers, the cost of imposing all of that through a centralized constitution can be enormous. So dispersing decision-making through a common law mechanism not only is a means for making use of dispersed knowledge, it's also a device for risk aversion. How likely are you to get it wrong? And so I will pose this as a question coming out of this part of my discussion. There are other kinds of institutional arrangements that have the same effect of serving as risk aversion devices. Two of them that are in the United States Constitution are federalism and separation of powers. And I'm just wondering whether Professor Smith, as a matter of ideal legal system design, thinks that the same considerations that lead her to written constitutionalism would also lead her away from federalism or separation of powers. And we can talk about that more later on. My guess is that callers are going to be more interested in part two, or book two, as I call it, the part on judicial review. As Professor Smith so ably said, that's harder to get right. It's very easy to criticize other people, especially when you see what the Legal Academy has to offer. It's much harder to provide a useful, positive account. And I don't have a useful, positive account either. I mean, I was a fan of the Seattle Pilots back in 1969, and Jim Boughton wrote about those. They wrote about them in Ball 4. They had the worst pitching staff in the history of Major League Baseball. So the pitching coach, Sal Magley, would be out on the mound 5 times a game. And what Boughton reported is that Magley would tell his young pitchers who are getting shelled into oblivion, throw a hard slider on the outside corner at the knees. And when we're talking about prescribing mechanisms for judicial review, it's very hard to say anything other than throw a hard slider on the outside corner at the knees. It's very difficult to operationalize that. So rather than get into those mechanics, let me just make two observations / comments, questions about part two, and then we can get into the discussion. The first has to do with a subject that I would have expected Professor Smith to discuss more. She talked a little bit about it in her opening comments, and I would like to hear even more about that. And that is, what is the nature of law? What counts as law? A modern constitutional theorist, Larry Solem, talks about what he calls the contribution thesis, the extent to which a constitution contributes to the content of law. Well, of course it contributes to the content of law, one might think. Well, but does it, at least in the fields that it covers, exhaust the content of law? Is there something to the content of law above and beyond what the Constitution says, so that when you're talking about unswerving devotion to the law, fidelity to the law, is the content of the law exhausted by what? So there's a question of what we sometimes call legal metaphysics that underlies this, that I think I would like to hear more about. The second, and this would probably be of more interest just to me and Professor Smith than to most of the people who are likely to call in here, both of us focus on the role of knowledge and therefore concepts and therefore language in understanding and applying theories of legal interpretation. What's interesting is that we both start from the same place, a theory of knowledge and a theory of concepts largely drawn from the work of Ayn Rand, built upon by a number of scholars over the ensuing decades. We come to radically different places from that. I think that that notion of concepts, language, leads inexorably to originalism as the method of discerning the meaning of legal norms. And Professor Smith comes out in a very, very different place. I don't think I have time in 5 minutes to sort through how that happens. So maybe what I will do is just leave those observations and see what the callers want to focus on, and we can go from there.
Great.
Thank you both. I will now open the floor to listener questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say floor request mode has been initiated. After that, push the star key and then the pound key on your phone to request the floor. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt that will say your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then pound on your telephone keypad. Professor Smith, if you want to respond to Professor Lawson's comments while we wait for any questions,
okay. Please
feel free.
Sure. I have to say, thanks. These were really good. I've taken down a million notes, and you've given me a lot to think about. This was very useful, and I mean that on the parts that are, you know, some challenges or questions or requests for further development. I'm not sure what I can say quickly. Let me say something about in part one, you say you would have liked more, perhaps, in my discussion of a written constitution. You think I underestimate the power of at least some versions of the common law or certain sorts of appeals to the common law. Strategically, this may not be the greatest thing to admit, but I wouldn't be surprised if you're right about that at all. That is, I take that as I have only gained more respect for the common law and its contributions to a legal system over my time in thinking about this. Now, I'm in no way backtracking on what I say in the book in terms of the superiority about a written constitution, but what I'm acknowledging, I guess, is that I do think it's an area that I would benefit from going into in more depth. I mean, just at first level, simply for my own understanding. And you know, you mentioned a few particular versions or defenders of common law who bring up different elements of the common law that I don't fully address in the book. So I take that as a sort of friendly suggestion. And I take your specific point about, you know, the risk aversion quality. And let me actually defend one thing I say a little bit further here, though. That is, you said something like that, you know, the more we know the right answers, the greater the benefits of, in effect, having them written down in a written constitution. But the more we're uncertain or we're still finding our way on answers to certain important legal questions about what the rules themselves ought to be, maybe then the benefits of having a common law sort of gradual accumulation of knowledge, maybe those benefits go way up. I wouldn't deny that. But part of the way I couch it in my discussion of some of the different merits of a written constitution and common law is that, just to put it in a sort of shorthand way, when common law gets it right, that is, when people come to what I think is ultimately a very good, proper, objective understanding of how the law should be used in some realm, some sort of dispute, it does so for reasons. It does so in a way that reflects the proper principles that should be animating the system overall. So once we have identified those, what it is that makes certain conventions, certain common law practices or concepts right or justified or valid, then I think we are better off translating those, in effect, into the terms of a written constitution. I'm not advocating that every which good rule we find, we should ultimately put down in writing. But I do appeal to that sort of, once we know, once we've learned certain really important principles, we are much safer in fulfilling the overall function of the government and of a legal system, safer, better off in terms of protecting individuals' rights, by giving that a more secure foundation in a written constitution as opposed to a common law system. But maybe we should see if any questions have materialized in the meantime.
I don't see any yet, but I'll remind our listeners that to ask a question, you enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. We actually do have our first question. So once you hear the prompt, you can go ahead and ask a question.
Yeah, I have a preface question and then a real question. I may have misunderstood Professor Lawson's comment on Professor Smith's view of sort of a written constitution. So my preface question is the conclusion of the first part of the book that you don't find written constitutions to be the best organizational tool for the structure of a legal system? You'd prefer, you know, a system that, you know, a British system or whatever, that doesn't have the legal or the written constitution?
No, that is, I'm very much defending a written constitution.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I thought I had heard that, but I must have misunderstood. So,
sure, no problem.
So then, kind of within the context of that, does your book, I mean, is your book kind of a direction about how people who believe that the interpretation of the written constitution should be objective, that you already buy into that principle, and then you're exploring how they should carry that out? Or do you try to convince the reader that being objective about the interpretation and application of the Constitution is the proper way to go about it? Because it seems to me that second approach is more the issue that's in dispute these days. I think perhaps a majority of judges either overtly or secretly in their souls really don't believe that they're bound to be objective. They're more interpreting the Constitution to get the policy results that they believe are proper public policy, kind of regardless of what the Constitution words say. So with that, I'll let you comment. Thank you.
Okay. Sure. No, I think that's a really interesting question. And I think people, not just in law and not just on courts, I think, you know, most Americans are in certain ways really confused about what objectivity is and whether or not objectivity is possible, and that, you know, infuses the legal system and people's attitudes as well as the rest of life. In one sense, I'm taking it for granted that people want the objective meaning of law, because I do think that implicitly, even people who espouse different, you know, legal scholars and other thinkers who espouse differing views of how judges should do their job, you know, if you ask them, but judges should go by the law, right? You're not going to find many people who disagree with that. Now, their versions of what it is to go by the law, they're going to be kind of all over the map, right? And they may implicitly elevate, or sometimes even explicitly elevate, some other things be above genuine objectivity. But if you made people think or really even talk about what it is they want the objective rule of law. And I mean, you can go on about it. You do find that at least implicitly in what most schools of judicial thought will say. So what I'm trying to do is bring under the microscope, what is objectivity? What is the real meaning of objectivity, and then the real meaning of objective law, to try to, you know, encourage people to pay more attention to this and to get serious about objectivity. Now, again, it gets more complicated than this, even in most people's understanding, because while it's become very fashionable and very prevalent to deny that objectivity is even possible, I mean, we see references just as casual asides that assume nobody can be objective, everybody's biased. We run into those every day of the week. At the same time, I think we also run into people being, you know, bloody peeved when they think that something that should have been treated objectively was not. So at best, people adhere to double standards on this, you know, professing the impossibility of objectivity until, you know, they know its absence when they see it and complain about that. So in a sense, I'm trying to appeal to the right-mindedness of seeking objective law, the rule of law, and then trying to illuminate, you know, some of what is required to actually get it.
Am I live?
Yes.
So I can interject at this point? Good.
Sure.
This is Professor Lawson again. It occurred to me that there is a concrete example that may illustrate one way in which Professor Smith and I, who start from very similar places, wind up with very, very different conclusions. So let me try this concrete example. The Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, adopted in 1791, says, among other things, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Let's put aside questions about what due process of law means or what the clause means as a whole. Let's just focus on the word liberty. Now, Professor Smith and I both think that there really is something out there that is a best understanding of human liberty, and we would both come up with very, very similar substantive understandings of what that best account of human liberty is. The question for constitutional interpretation comes from this. Most educated people in 1791 would see the word liberty in a legal document, and they would understand it to mean not what Professor Smith and I think is the best account of human liberty, but something far narrower, freedom of movement, freedom of locomotion. There are all sorts of things, aspects, that Professor Smith and I think are vital, substantive, objectively correct features of human liberty that people in 1791, seeing that word in a legal document, would not include in it. Question, what is the meaning of the word liberty in the Constitution of the United States in the Fifth Amendment, ratified in 1791? I maintain, as an originalist, that it's the 1791 understanding of the contours of that concept that determines its meaning. Professor Smith, as I understand her, maintains that that is not objective, that's subjective, because it focuses on the thoughts that are in certain people's minds rather than the real objective nature of what liberty represents. And that's something on which we strongly disagree, because I think the nature of language and of communication necessarily means that the reference of concepts, the things to which concepts refer, are always going to be determined by the thoughts of particular, situated, specific individuals. Once you've got those concepts, the things to which they refer are what they are, and you can learn more about them. And people in 1791 may have thought that only some things could restrict freedom of movement, and now we know that there are more sophisticated ways of restricting freedom of movement, and I would certainly think those would be included. But the question is whether the contours of the concept, the things that determine whether something does or does not fall within liberty rather than, say, property or some other thing with which it might be confused, is fixed by understandings at a particular historically situated moment in time. I think it is, and as I understand Professor Smith, she thinks it's not, and I just want to clarify that that's something on which we would disagree.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is something on which we disagree. I don't think the objective meaning of concepts is determined, to use one of your terms, is determined by people's beliefs at any one time. It is certainly importantly related to people's beliefs and how they're using terms at a certain time, but it is not simply confined to or fixed by the beliefs of people at any time, 1791, 2015, whenever it might be. Our beliefs about the reference of a concept, the concept of liberty or whatever it might be, our beliefs are our beliefs. They're fallible. We're not omniscient. I'm not claiming that contemporary speakers or thinkers or philosophers are omniscient, are necessarily utterly correct in a never-to-be improved-upon way. But insofar as laws are not about the speakers of the laws, they're not about the beliefs of the writers of the laws. That's not what they're about. A law about liberty is about liberty. It's about a phenomenon. Liberty is a word that was used in 1791 by certain people who had a then understanding of liberty. But once we secure that we're not talking about something completely different, we're not pulling some sort of bait and switch, you know, just the quick call me example, we're not using reference to banks that was in some law to refer to financial institution banks and treating it as if it referred to the Outer Banks of North Carolina, right? Once we have established that we're talking about the same basic kind of thing, then I think it is not only open to us, but imperative that we go by the best knowledge, you know, the best understanding, the most honest, scrupulous, objective understanding of what the given word, bank, liberty, etc., refers to in fact. Because when you publish laws, you're saying the meaning of these is what will govern people, govern how legal power is used, and so on. So I do think that the originalist view, and obviously this is going to vary, you know, somewhat depending on the particular species of originalism and the different advocates, and there are, I think, stronger and ones that have more sophisticated understandings of language than others. But speaking broadly, I do find the originalist understanding of language ultimately subjectivist in that it gives undue power in terms of understanding the meaning of language and the meaning of laws to the beliefs of the speakers. I mean, one way maybe of coming at the thought is to say this: making law doesn't make meaning. You can make laws in 1791, and we're obligated to follow those laws until or unless we change them. But you don't decree the very meaning of the laws. Again, what you're expressing is about the subject matter of given laws, about, you know, liberty or equal protection or whatever it might be. You're not making the subject our beliefs, the our there being we the lawmakers. That's to say something about our difference here, I think. But I think this is a tricky business. This is an intricate part of my argument against certain originalists. And obviously, you know, since typically a FedSoc member is going to be most attracted to originalism, it's where I do think the originalists are in effect so close but yet so far. I think ultimately, and I try to show this in my discussion of a few versions of originalism, they do fall prey to, without meaning to in any sense, but I think they fall prey to a subjectivist understanding of what language refers to.
Let me remind our listeners that if you want to ask a question, you just enter star and then pound, and then we will go to you as soon as we see that you've requested the floor. And in the meantime, let me announce that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call will be on Tuesday, November 3rd at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And then we're going to host a Courthouse Steps program about the Supreme Court arguments in Spokio versus Robbins, a big upcoming case. So please consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforums on the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org. And also visit our website to listen to podcasts of previously recorded Teleforums that you might have missed.
I mean, I guess one thing I might add is to say that I do think originalism, in certain versions, mistakes word usage for word meaning, right? But we're not just interested in how were these words and these laws used in 1791 or whatever. We're not simply interested in that. We're interested in the concepts that the words represented and the meaning of those concepts. And again, just to give another, you know, example to try to get at some of the subtle differences here. When in biology, taxonomists eventually reclassified whales and said, you know, they're not fish, they're mammals. They weren't changing the subject. They were still talking about whales, the same kind of thing, but with a better understanding, even to such an extent that it was a fairly dramatic reclassification. But they were being faithful to the basic kind of thing that was referred to. And that, I think, is what we need to do with laws as well.
Well, here's where I think that's different from the liberty example.
Okay.
Yes, we're learning more about whales, but the things, other things swimming in the water from which the whales are being distinguished, dolphins or porpoises or sharks or starfish, I mean, the considerations that justified grouping this particular set of big hulking things swallowing up plankton into a grouping, that cognitive context didn't change. What changed is we learned more about the things that we grouped. In 1791, there was a certain set of governmental restrictions that the word liberty was used to describe. The actual concept was those set of restrictions. It wasn't every possible restriction that would interfere with what a pure normative theory that you and I would both agree 98% on or 99% on would prescribe. It was a relatively narrow subset of kinds of things that governments were doing, and they happened to choose the word liberty because there was an historical use of it to that effect, to sort out that set of things. Yeah, as we learn more about that particular set of things, those are encompassed in the meaning. What I would wonder is, is it a bait and switch like switching the meanings of banks to go from that relatively narrow set of things that were being distinguished from all other government actions with which it might be confused, to move to a broader conception of liberty as you or I might today use that word in a different context to describe the appropriate sphere of activity of people? I mean, is that more like figuring out that whales are mammals, or more like moving from riverbanks to financial institutions?
I think that the answer depends on how different this set of restrictions that you're saying they had in mind when they used the term liberty back then, how different that set of restrictions was from contemporary understandings of liberty. And I mean, just being completely straightforward and candid here, I don't know. I mean, in one sense, it sounds like what you're saying would be big news to me, but I'm not a historical scholar, okay? So, you know, you may be correct, but this would be big news, that is, if their understanding of the term liberty were so different that it would be a bait and switch to use liberty in some of the more capacious senses that we use it today, still bounded certainly, but not just a certain set of only physical restrictions, purely physical restrictions. I mean, is that how you take it?
Yeah,
that it is really
radically different
from your own understanding of proper liberty for government.
Yeah, as an empirical matter, I think it is a bait and switch of that kind. There really is very powerful, just empirical, historical, linguistic evidence of word usage in that context that mm-hmm. would indicate that the word liberty in 1791 in a legal document in that kind of setting described freedom of locomotion. Now, to fill that in, the word life in that context had a much broader understanding at that time than we would have it today. For example, actions by government that damaged people's reputation would have uncontroversially in 1791 been understood as deprivations of life.
Mm-hmm.
So
in effect, you can save libertarianism by looking at life rather than liberty
in
the ways.
A more libertarian
reading of the founders.
You're going to get different results. Very hard to read the Constitution of 1791 as a libertarian document. As a libertarian, I'd like to be able to do it. As an originalist,
uh-huh.
I don't think that
okay.
I can. I think it's
okay,
a lot
okay.
more libertarian than any, you know, the non-constitutional world that we see around us, but it's not going to get
uh-huh.
you all the way there.
Okay.
I don't think it's going to get you, for example, see if this will get a rise out of it. I don't think
uh-huh.
it's going to get you
uh-huh.
prohibitions on government regulations of abortion. I don't think you're going to get that out of life. I don't think you're going to get that out of liberty. I don't think you're going to get that out of property. The general point I was trying to make was just to try to pin down just how mm-hmm. capaciously you mm-hmm. think objective understandings of language allow word usages to change over time in the context of legal interpretation.
Yeah.
Because again, I think it's more interesting to you and me than it may be to everyone else. I just think it's fascinating that we start from the same premises and get to different places.
Right. No. And I mean, this is a central issue and a crucial issue. Let me just first say a word again on the particular Fifth Amendment example. I mean, in one sense, you know, when you say, well, now look, at the same time, to fill in the context, they had a much broader understanding of life and what that referred to. So insofar as the amendment speaks to life, liberty, you know, and so on, in a way, that's, you know, just an instance of, yeah, context makes a difference to what any language means, and taking things out of context or in context puts very different complexions on the meaning. My main thrust is to say, but what the meaning is of any term whenever it's used is not simply, and I want to underscore the simply there, right? It is not simply or solely that set of referents of items referred to that the speakers at a given time would have given. They are fallible. They might have included things that they shouldn't have or excluded things that they shouldn't have. So in that sense, the law and a proper objective understanding of the law, the meaning of the words in which the law is written, always has to be open to correction. In a given case, a lot will depend. Crucially, if one can show that they really meant something different in fundamental kind from what we mean by that very same word, then yes, it would be unfair to interpret the writers of a given law as if they meant that second concept when they meant, right? But that's going to rely completely, really, on the empirical case that they meant utterly, completely different, as opposed to they were using this concept. The later knowledge allows us to refine the exact reference or sometimes even some of the governing criteria. So I do, you know, in the one chapter in the book where I'm critiquing a few forms of originalism, I go through a few different possible understandings of what the words refer to try to make clear why I think we do need to be, in order to escape subjectivism, in order to get at the objective meaning here.
Let's go to our next caller who has a question really quickly.
I was confused by the discussion, and I was wondering if you could...
I'm having trouble understanding, I'm sorry.
I have no connection.
Can you hear me now?
Barely. There's a lot of
static. There's a lot of static. Static, yes.
All right, now.
Better?
Okay, sorry about that.
Somewhat better, but still a lot of static. So
yeah, agreed.
We could try to struggle, but...
How about now?
Perfect.
Much better.
All right.
Thank you.
I was just kind of confused by the discussion, and I was wondering if you could tell me if there's any difference, in your opinion, between intersubjective... sort of the intersubjective meaning of language and the objective meaning of language.
This may be annoying, this may be frustrating. It depends on what you mean by the intersubjective meaning of language. Let me just say this. I do distinguish in the book between objective meaning and intrinsic meaning, a different conception that people sometimes have of the objective. That is, I think people are often clear in opposition to what they regard as subjective, depending on the subjects, the speakers, the beliefs of the speakers, you know, the minds of those who happen to agree on a certain view. And in opposition to a subjectivist view or a subjectivist understanding of language, they often will glom on to what ends up being, I think, a false alternative to that, an intrinsicist conception of language as utterly, completely given in the words that are spoken or the words that are written. So objective, on my understanding, is relational, and certainly it involves human beings using language, certain words in this code, to stand for certain different kinds of things. It's not an isolated one. But so I think the ultimate answer might depend a little bit more precisely on exactly what you mean by intersubjective, but I certainly don't mean to treat objective meaning as intrinsic meaning or people independent meaning. Meaning,
all right, yeah,
is a way that human beings use, I mean, we use language to mean things, to refer to things, to communicate ideas. So in that sense, there's certainly an important sense, a relationship going on. Is that of any help?
I think that helps. I always understood originalism as a way to get at the intersubjective meaning of words in, you know, 1786 or whatnot. So that's my understanding of it. In that sense, I thought it was, you know, the most objective form of constitutional interpretation that you could get, you know, giving everybody's fallibility. But I wonder if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, I would put it a little bit differently. If I interject, I could put it a little bit differently. A little bit differently on this. Anytime we use language is a tool for representing concepts. Concepts are a tool for representing things. So ultimately, what we're trying to do is organize the things, the relations in the world, and it goes from world to concepts to language. And the language, once you have it, serves two functions. One is for your own internal organization, to turn abstract ways of organizing the world into things that are easier to work with. And there's the second function of allowing you to communicate with other people about it. The thing is, when you're using the words to communicate to other people, what you're really doing is using the words to communicate using concepts, which are your ways of communicating things about the world. There's always going to be some specific, concrete human beings framework, the set of things in the world that they're trying to organize, that's going to determine how any particular set of concepts are organized, how any particular set of words relate to those concepts. Most of the time, because the world is the way that it is, and most people's minds are structured the way that they are, there's a huge overlap between the way that different people perform all of those different stages of the operation. That's what lets us have this particular phone conversation. But ultimately, at the base, you're going to have to pick somebody's conceptual framework as the ground, as the thing that determines what parts of the world you're talking about. My understanding of originalism has always been that it fixes the point in time at which we look for somebody's conceptual framework. And this is where this may be a difference of expression between me and Professor Smith. I don't think that's subjectivism at all. I just think that's the nature of language, concepts, and communication, that they're always things that are meant by someone. And when you've got words written down and we read them in 2015, we can either use the conceptual framework of somebody in 2015 or the conceptual framework of somebody in, you know, 1923 or the conceptual framework of somebody in 1791 or 1788.
Right.
And originalism as a matter, and it can be either as a matter of interpretation or it can be as a matter of normative, there's all sorts of different ways to do it, is just a way of fixing where we look for that conceptual framework. So I don't know if that's an answer to the question. But that's how I understand originalism.
Okay, now that's really helpful. I was nodding yes to a lot of that and nodding no to parts of that as well. So let me just try to quickly say a few things. I completely agree with some of what you were saying in the very beginning about language serving two functions, both a sort of internal, helping you to understand and make sense of and classify things for oneself, as well as communicative. And as I was speaking before that, I even thought, gee, this might sound a little bit too much just focused on the communication aspect or function of language. So thank you for bringing up the other as well. Now, I could completely agree that we have to look through the conceptual framework of the people who are writing the law. I think where we differ is about how much that conceptual framework gives you. It gives you the framework of the meaning of the laws and the language they used in writing and enacting the laws that they did. It gives you the framework which sets the boundaries and the parameters of, you can't use bank now in this completely different sense when they weren't using it that way there, right? But a conceptual framework isn't a set of answers to all questions about the concepts that we are using and the language that we are using to express our concepts. So if we have a misunderstanding of what liberty is, or what a toxin is, or whatever the relevant law might be, what speech is. You know, they didn't have email as speech in the 18th century and so on. But so we want to understand the conceptual framework, but a conceptual framework isn't limited to or confined by the specific understanding of the speakers of the language at that time using that conceptual framework. We are not stuck with just their then understanding of all of the aspects of what the concepts referred to. So there are some finer differences here that I think do remain between us.
Well, actually, I agree with all of that, and I think most sophisticated originalists today would. There is still a large segment who I think do exactly what you say correctly they shouldn't do. And that is try to restrict meaning to the specific things, mm-hmm. the particular characteristics, mm-hmm. and properties of those things that were within understanding at a particular moment in time. There are even people who will say, if they were on this phone call, oh, no, I don't believe that, mm-hmm. who will then mm-hmm. do it. So I think mm-hmm. you're absolutely right to point
yeah.
that out.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think we have succeeded in narrowing the distance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make an originalist of you yet.
well, we'll see. But
I'm looking forward to being able to bring you over to the dark side.
No, this has been very useful. I look forward to talking much more, Professor Lewis, because this has been really useful. And just to this last question, I want to say, while most of our discussion this afternoon has focused on the fine points of difference, I think, between Professor Lawson and myself, in the larger scheme,
yes.
they are smaller points.
Yes.
I think I'm completely with you on, hey, look, at least the originalists seem to want to be faithful to the context in which the laws were written. God bless originalists for that. I mean, even I will say that, though, again, if you want to try to understand my take on how originalism is not yet objectivity, then I would recommend that you look at the book.
I would as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Professors Tara Smith and Gary Lawson for joining us today. And thank you also to our audience. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please join us for our next teleforum on Tuesday, November 3rd at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.